Morning, everyone. Maybe a quick question while I get everything arranged up here. Just out of curiosity, has anyone not heard this story before? Okay, yep, I guess that's in line with my assumptions. Yeah, I mean, like, even for me, you know, for studying this passage for years, for leading Bible studies on it, for doing a research project on it while I was in Bible college, yeah, I thought, like, oh, I know this passage, like, pretty well. You know, maybe not back to front, but, like, pretty familiar with it. And even still this week, in preparing for this sermon, like, new stuff, you know, popped out at me. So I'm reminded that it's a dangerous assumption to think that you know a Bible passage, like, so well that I don't even need to touch it anymore, kind of thing. So I just want to encourage you, step into it with me. And yeah, I'm actually really excited to go over this passage. Yeah, for years, like I was saying, I found it to be deceptively difficult, you know, kind of seemingly easy to understand at face value, but I think the closer you look at it, the more questions seem to pop up for me. It's almost like saying something like, you know, the sky is blue because that's the color it is, right? It's self-evident. But then, like, when you look closer at it, you get more questions like, you know, air is clear, right? How is clear air blue? Like, this doesn't make any sense, right? Like, surely this story, this account, is about Israel's waywardness and the human's heart, the human heart's proficiency to seek after idols, you know, even after it's confronted with the reality of the one true God. But I think there's more to it. We can get more out of it by focusing a little deeper and looking at the minutia. Some of those questions, yes, so this is a picture I found, the golden calf. Yeah, some of the questions that I've been kind of gnawing on for the past while, like, how is it that Aaron, you know, divinely appointed mouthpiece to Moses, you know, enactor of plagues, you know, he had experience, like, you know, starting the plagues off. He's firsthand witness to many miracles of the Lord. Why is he so complicit in making this idol, right? In the account, how does he, like, fashion it with an engraving tool? Like, how does the mechanism of making it even work? After doing so, why does he proceed to proclaim a festival to the Lord? Like, that's a little unusual. And then after everything happens, you know, how is a golden statue burned? You know, gold being one of the least reactive metals that we know of. And then how is it then ground to dust and then dispersed in water in a way in which it can be drunk? You know, like, people go panning for gold all the time because it's a property of gold to sink in water. So, like, how does this even make sense? Is the account even accurate? Right? How is it that Aaron not only seems to get away with making the calf, but then lying about it afterwards to Moses? And then he not only survives his transgression, but then goes on to be divinely appointed as head priest. Does any of this make sense? It's quite confusing to me. Even if we come to a reasonable conclusion that, you know, through this passage, like, idols are bad, you know, when glazing over, you know, these, like, questions that come up as we look closely at the passage, I believe we can come away with a deeper, more robust, more resilient understanding of what this episode in Israel's history has to say to us today when we, yeah, address some of these finer details. But before we get into that, how we just review, how did we get here? How is Israel in this place to begin with? So just a quick review. If you recall what we've been going over the past few weeks, we started with Israel enslaved in Egypt for over 400 years. Miraculously, Moses, as an Israelite, was adopted into the Egyptian royal family, being, like, perfectly positioned to be raised up as this ideal, like, Egyptian-Israeli diplomat, reconciling the Egyptians and the Israelites back, like, how they were in Joseph's day. But then things go wrong. You know, Moses murders an Egyptian slave driver in anger, and then he flees into the wilderness. And then after that, the Lord appears to Moses in the burning bush and then commissions him nevertheless to go back and lead Israel out of slavery. When doing so, Pharaoh, however, refuses to let Israel go many times, despite Egypt being subject to multitude of plagues sent by God, in the process undermining the Egyptian pantheon of gods. And then finally, Pharaoh relents after the death of his firstborn son, and then lets Israel go. And then as Israel, they reach an otherwise impassable sea, Pharaoh again goes back on his word and pursues them. God causes the sea waters to recede, so Israel can pass through and go to the other side, but washes away Pharaoh's armies when they try to follow. And then Israel makes their way to the foot of Mount Sinai, where here the Lord speaks to the people, and he tells them his intentions for them, right? That they would be his people, and that he would be their God, and that he would raise them up as a nation of priests, so that through them the whole world will be blessed. And as Nathan preached on last week, in order to do that, the people would need to abide by God's way and follow his commandments. Finally, after that, the people agree, pronouncing their vows to God, and the Israelite leaders, they like go up the mountain a little bit, they gather, they actually see God, they see a theophany, like an appearance of the pre-incarnate God. And then in his presence, they seal this new layer to the covenant between God and his people. From this point, Moses then ascends up to the mountain for 40 days and nights to commune with God and receive further instructions on what the nation is to do next. So with this, all of that happened. Now we begin our passage for today. So apparently, Moses has been up on the mountain for 40 days and nights, and that's just too much for some of the people. So then they approach Aaron. So beginning in verse 1, when the people saw that Moses delayed in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said to him, "Come make gods for us who will go before us, because this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him." Now, okay, on the one hand, I can understand the people being concerned. You know, 40 days, like, it's not nothing, right? And Moses isn't about to send a text to let them know that he's okay. And from what we know about Mount Sinai, like archaeologically, it's likely to be a fairly high and dangerous mountain to hike on its own. And then I can imagine it feeling particularly dangerous, like looming with storm clouds and like the presence of God. So yeah, I can understand the people's concern, like what happened to Moses. On the other hand, like why exactly is the solution to these concerns not like, "Hey Aaron, Moses seems to have been gone for a long time. Can we send up a search party and see what happened?" Or like, "Aaron, we're worried that Moses isn't coming back. As the de facto second in command, do you have any ideas on what our next steps should be?" Like having, you know, "Aaron, make us new gods," you know, be your solution to these concerns, it seems a little bit extreme, right? And then compounded on that, how does Aaron respond to these demands? You know, does he say like, "Oh guys, what are you talking about? You know, we just promised that we'd be Yahweh's people like just a month ago. You know, we heard his voice, we saw him ourselves. Like just look up at the top of the mountain and we could still see his presence. Like just be patient, I'm sure we'll hear more soon." Obviously, that's not the answer we get. Aaron replied to them, "Take off the gold rings that are on the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters and bring them to me." So all the people took off the gold rings that were on their ears and brought them to Aaron. He took the gold from them, fashioned it with an engraving tool or a stylus, and he made it into the image of a calf. How is this possible? Like, if we read through the few preceding chapters, we see that at this very moment on the top of the mountain, God is outlining how Aaron is going to take on the priesthood. You know, from how he's going to be performing his duties to what he's going to wear in the tabernacle. How could Moses' brother and then right-hand man do this? You know, certainly it's not good. Like, there's nothing about this that ends with this being a good decision on Aaron's point. As we went over last week in Exodus 20, the people have already been told multiple times to not make idols or worship any other gods than Yahweh. With this, though, there is a very slight possibility that things aren't quite as bad as they seem. If we consider how ancient Near Easterners of the time period thought about gods and the divine and how they work and things like that. Maybe, at least starting out, this could have been a poor attempt on Aaron's part to take up the torch of leading the people, assuming that Moses really wasn't coming back. So how did that work? So ancient Near Easterners at the time, like the Israelites, they didn't quite understand gods to be like omnipresent, accessible anywhere at any time, in any place. Instead, gods were considered to be local, right? So like the gods of Egypt, they pretty much stayed in Egypt. They didn't really have influence outside of the nation. If you wanted to meet with this god, you go over to like this forest because that's where he lives. If you wanted to meet with that god, you go over to that mountain because that's where he lives. So like if you think about where are the Israelites like right now, they're at the foot of what very much appears to be Yahweh's mountain, right? Like God is there. I can like look up and see the storm clouds, right? They're camping outside his doorstep. So being in his territory, presumably the only, you know, Elohim, you know, the only divine being that there is to invoke is Yahweh himself, right? So it could be possible that when Aaron begins his endeavor to fulfill the people's request, he's doing so while still trying to bring the people back to the Lord, even though it's kind of a bad way to go about doing it. And if you think back to verse 5, I don't know if I have it up here yet. Aaron curiously declares that this is going to be a festival to the Lord when placing an altar in front of the calf, right? So why would he declare that, like, this is Yahweh, right? This is a festival to Yahweh, rather. But then you might ask, okay, that might be one thing, but then if this is the case, surely Aaron, of all people, wouldn't have missed the multiple times that God prohibited the creation of idols and images of worship, right? So if so, what did Aaron really set out to create when he created the calf? So understandably, there is a lot of academic interest in this passage and a lot of published theories as to what was going on. But the general consensus seems to be that the idea of like a life-size solid gold statue as depicted in movies like The Ten Commandments, it probably wasn't what the golden calf actually was, right? I ran some calculations, given the volume of a 3D model of the calf, about how much a statue like this would weigh. So assuming the average size of a 90-day-old calf, so that's like about a meter tall or so, this would result in a solid gold statue that's about 5 metric tons. So that's about the weight of an African elephant or like a moderately sized bulldozer. So it doesn't exactly seem like a reasonable size, especially for a group that was expecting to travel, right? You know, they're not like setting up shop permanently at the foot of Mount Sinai, right? So some people have suggested, oh, well, maybe it's a gilded statue, right? It's like wooden underneath and just like layered with gold on top. And yes, this was a commonly practiced method of creating idols, especially in Egypt. But then this goes against what we're told about the calf's creation in the account itself. So on the one hand, gilding would only require a very small amount of gold relative to a cast idol. So like collecting all of these earrings doesn't really make that much sense. And then there's no mention of like pounding them out into like really thin sheets or carving an underlying wooden structure. Instead, the description in verses 2 and 4 sound more like Aaron is carving a wax model that would then be used in a lost wax casting method. And then you know, the words even translate into, you know, they made a molten calf. Some translations use that instead. So it seems like it's really a solid gold statue of some kind. So if we look at other examples of cast idols from the time period, it's much more likely that this was a fairly small object, like just big enough to be seen by a crowd when placed up on a pedestal, but then small enough to be realistically made and then carried. So I think this picture does a pretty good job at estimating what that might be like. So something on the order of like a foot tall, like 30 centimeters tall, it would only weigh about 25 kilograms, which is still pretty heavy for the size, but it seems like much more reasonable of an object to make, right? So that's like what the calf looked like, what it is. But then like what's Aaron's intentions in making it? A number of scholars think that Aaron was maybe making something like this. So these are idols from the time period and from the area. And scholars believe that they're depicting Baal riding on a bull. Yeah, if you can kind of see, the middle one is the clearest. The other ones are kind of blobby, but if you can kind of imagine the extra details that maybe have been lost over time. If Aaron pursued to make something like this, like the Lord's prohibitions against creating objects of worship and like depicting him, like he can kind of skirt around those, right? If he only makes the calf underneath, but then God remains undepicted on top of it, then the calf just turns in a pedestal for God, right? Something like that. And if you think about it, this isn't a completely unprecedented thing, even in the Bible, right? Like, what's another golden object that God isn't in? Like, it doesn't contain God's presence, but it serves as more of a platform for God to be, like, present above it. The Ark, right? The Ark of the Covenant is pretty much exactly that, right? It's not a box that contains God. It contains the covenant, right? And then God's presence is, like, between the cherubim on top. So while the calf definitely, like, was unsanctioned, like, God didn't ask Aaron to make this, and we even see that, like, at this moment on top of the mountain, God could have been commissioning the proper Ark of the Covenant. In Exodus 25, we get all of the accounts of that and, like, the dimensions and everything like that. Even though he shouldn't have done it, maybe it wasn't as ill-intentioned as it initially appears, right? But nevertheless, whatever Aaron's original intentions, we can see that things certainly get out of hand quickly. So as soon as the people see it, they declare, you know, Israel, these are your gods who brought you up from the land of Egypt, right? And then if we go on to verse 6, I think I have that. We can see this clear shift happen among the people, right? It says, early the next morning they arose, offered burnt offerings, and presented fellowship offerings. The people sat down to eat and drink, and then they got up to party. So some transition seems to happen between them sitting and them getting up, right? So maybe when they began this festival, the majority of the people were still directing it to the Lord, you know, maybe, because Aaron declares this will be a festival to Yahweh, right? But then they sit down, and when they get up to party. And we know that this phrase, they got up to party, or some translations say they get up to play, is very likely a softened and like euphemistic way of describing what they actually set about to do. And based on how that word is used elsewhere in the Bible, it's very likely something sexual in nature. And there are many theories that I won't specifically get into today, but it definitely wasn't good. You know, anything like sexual in nature like this, it's like sexually immoral, right? And this isn't how you honored and worshiped Yahweh, right? This isn't what God was talking about when he like verbally proclaimed, you know, the Ten Commandments to the people on how they're entering a relationship with God. During this transition, if it hadn't already happened before, the people's focus has clearly shifted away from God, if he was undepicted above the calf, to the calf itself, right? The calf has now become the object of worship, like, undisputably, right? And then we get confirmation of this within the passage itself, when God interrupts his talk with Moses and tells him about what's happening. So in verse 7, it starts, "The Lord spoke to Moses, 'Go down at once, for your people you brought up from the land of Egypt have acted corruptly. They have quickly turned from the way I commanded them. They have made themselves an image of a calf. They have bowed down to it, sacrificed to it, and said, Israel, these are your gods who brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" God says plainly that the people's hearts have turned, and that mere days after personally affirming their covenant with God, you know, as Abraham's descendants, part of their covenant, right? Like, for the past 400 years, they've been betrothed to God in a way, promised to God, right? And now that they've like finally been like married, if you will, you know, in just over a month, they're already unfaithful, right? You know, understandably, God is not happy about this. It says in verse 9, the Lord also said to Moses, I have seen this people. They are indeed a stiff-necked people. They're really stubborn. Now leave me alone so that my anger can burn against them and I can destroy them. Then I will make you into a great nation. So we see here, like, even in God's anger, he's not giving up on his promise to Abraham, you know, this, like, overarching covenant to, you know, create a people from Abraham's line to bring them to the land, the promised land, to bless the world. You know, Moses is still part of that, right? But then with the Israelites breaking their promise to God, you know, their specific covenant with him, he offers to fulfill it in a different way, through Moses. But then Moses interjects, right? So in 11, he says, Lord, why does your anger burn against your people? You brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and a strong hand. Why should the Egyptians say, he brought them out with an evil intent to kill them in the mountains and eliminate them from the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce anger and relent concerning this disaster planned for your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. You swore to them by yourself and declared, I will make your offspring as numerous as the stars of the sky, and I will give your offspring all this land that I have promised, and they will inherit it forever. So the Lord relented concerning the disaster he had said he would bring on his people. So does Moses really change God's mind? Would God really not have considered what the other nations might think? Yeah, I don't think so, right? I think God is prompting Moses to make the right choice and to say the right thing, especially considering what we'll see in a few verses when it then becomes Moses' responsibility to confront the people and then enact justice against their sin. I've actually found myself doing something like this with Jedi sometimes. Gotta have a Jedi example, I guess. Lately, when he's been really upset, you know, say, you know, he's playing and we tell him, like, oh, it's time for a nap, and he wants to keep playing. He's picked up things from school, and, you know, sometimes he'll try and, like, hit us, like, no, and, you know, be angry in that way, right? So when that happens, we'll remind him of some advice that we've taken from Daniel Tiger, where we'll tell him, it's okay to feel angry, right? It's okay that you feel upset, but it's not okay to hurt someone. It's not okay to, like, act out your anger in this way, right? So we'll tell him, right? But then how do you make it stick? You know, he's only 3 years old. Sometimes things take a long time to really seep in. So occasionally, something will happen like we're eating dinner, and Shirley will put some broccoli on my plate, and I'm not a big fan of broccoli. I could do without it. And I'll kind of act like Jedi, you know, just kind of, you know, jokingly in a way. I'll say, like, I don't want broccoli. Oh, it's yucky. And I'll, like, go and, like, pretend to try and hit Shirley, right? And then how does Jedi respond to this? But he says, hey, you know, we don't hit, right? You know, broccoli's good for you, you know? So by me assuming his role, Jedi assumes our role as parents, right? And it reinforces this value that we've been trying to, you know, ingrain in him. So he gets to, like, try it on for size and adopt it as his own. So I think with God assuming a human response to this, it encourages Moses to take on the godly response, appealing for mercy on behalf of the people, and then preparing Moses for when he has to face them and respond to their sin in person, right? So from there, Moses descends the mountain and is confronted with the realities of the people's sin. It says in verse 19, there we go, this one. As he approached the camp, he saw the calf and the dancing. Moses became enraged and threw the tablets out of his hand, smashing them at the base of the mountain. He took the calf they had made, he burned it up, and ground it into powder. He scattered the powder over the surface of the water and forced the Israelites to drink the water. So yeah, like he sees it with his own eyes, and what's his emotional response? He becomes enraged, right? So I think, you know, what if he didn't say these things about, like, oh, repent and relent and things like that? You know, now if Moses overreacted, he'd be eating his own words, right? So I think it holds him back a little bit. But he still reacts quite harshly. You know, these tablets written by God's own hands, the physical representation of the people's covenant with the Lord, with the people having broken that covenant now, you know, Moses like dashes them to the ground. It's like a very visceral physical representation of what the people have broken immaterially between them and God. So then he proceeds to take the calf and then destroy, you know, this object that contributed to the people's disobedience. Like I talked about in the beginning, I have a lot of questions about this section. How does this work? Most importantly about this section, I want us to grasp the scale of time, right? The narrative moves very quickly. So it sounds like after Moses comes down from the mountain, like things happen like really fast. Like this is Moses's emotional response, his reaction to it, and he's hasty in how he responds. I don't think that's the case, even though the narrative moves so quickly. Even with a 25 kilogram, 30 centimeter tall calf, the process of melting it down and grinding it up and then dispersing it in the drinking water, this like just could not have been a fast process. This would have taken a lot of time and intentionality to do. So it might have even taken like a few days, giving Moses like plenty of time to consider next steps and to not act hastily, you know, not act just out of his emotions. So I guess with you know, those questions that I had about how is a golden statue burnt and then dispersed in water in such a way that it could have been drunk by the Israelites, looking into it, there are like many theories about it. They range from the gold being like chemically altered somehow to dissolved with acarija, like this special acid, or that, you know, this one guy said like, oh, it's not the calf that's dispersed in the water, but it's actually the tablets of the covenant that were dispersed in the water, which is an interesting idea, but then it's like totally not supported in the text either here or in Deuteronomy. So a good idea, but doesn't really answer the question. So at the end of the day, the most compelling research that I found was of a person who like just decided to try it. He just decided to like get some period accurate gold and use some period accurate methods to see like what would happen if he like just burned it and ground it up. So his main findings were that given that gold, the gold that they used was most likely alloyed with other metals that could oxidize, it produced much more slag and impurities than pure gold would have. And then those impurities tended to float on the water. With this, he ground it up using something like millstones, which they would have had at the time. And to his surprise, like this method of grinding it up was like easily able to produce extremely small particles, like on the nanoparticle scale. So the picture on this side, so these are gold nanoparticles suspended in water. It's something that is used a lot in like medical research. And interestingly, you can get different colors out of the water depending on the size of the nanoparticles and how light like interacts with it. Anyway, all that to say, like this is a thing that people do all the time these days, is they suspend gold in water, right? As long as the gold is small enough. Like if you think about how they homogenize milk, or even if you think about like air bubbles in honey, right? If you like shook up honey, even though the air in the honey is like way less dense than the honey itself, because the air bubbles are so small, they're then now subject to like the viscosity of the honey and they remain trapped in place, right? So yes, all of this to say, by doing the research, he found that, oh, surprisingly, despite our like contemporary assumptions about the biblical account, sometimes we think we know more than we do, right? That was his main takeaway. Sometimes we assume that we're smarter than people used to be, and we have to assume that we don't always have the full picture, and that maybe we can trust something like the biblical account a little more than we naturally do from our current position. So I thought that was interesting, and I have more confidence in this part of the account now after going down that rabbit hole. So Moses does this. Moses grinds up the calf, disperses it in the water, And then, after doing all of that, which could have taken a long time, he finally approaches Aaron and then asks him, like, what happens? And we get this truly baffling response from Aaron. Maybe he had, like, all this time to think up a new story, or I don't know what. But in verse 21, he says, "Then Moses asked Aaron, 'What did these people do to you that you have led them into such grave sin?' And then he responds, 'Don't be enraged, my Lord. You yourself know that the people are intent on evil. They said to me, "Make gods for us who will go before us," because this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him. So I said to them, "Whoever has gold, take it off." And then they gave it to me. When I threw it into the fire, out came this calf." Is this a true account of what happened? Does Aaron's account even answer Moses' question? Like, why did he do it? It, like, totally skirts around what he's actually being confronted with. He has no excuse. You know, the people didn't threaten him to make this idol. They didn't, force him to do it. And since he doesn't have a good excuse, he tries to pass the blame, right? It was the people's fault for asking for it, and it was the work of some kind of, like, divine intervention that made the calf into what it is, right? Thinking about this, I did briefly contemplate whether or not the calf that Aaron made was just, like, so ugly that, like, maybe this was a believable story. Like, maybe he just, like, poured molten gold into a fire and, like, some blobby thing that kind of looked vaguely like a calf came out. But yeah, the passage clearly says that Aaron had a direct hand in the designing and crafting of this calf. So, like, he's definitely lying about his involvement in making it. So if that's the case, like, how can it be that Aaron isn't just struck down by lightning on the spot, right? How can it be that not only does he not die, but he is later confirmed by God to be the head priest, right? In Numbers, we get this account that there will eventually be a group of rebels that rise up in the Israelite camp, and then they question the legitimacy of the priesthood. The Israelites test to see who God will accept into his presence. And sure enough, it's Aaron's staff that blossoms and puts forth fresh almonds, right? And then, interestingly enough, what happens to the rebels who question the legitimacy of the priesthood? The earth opens up, and them and their families and everything they own get swallowed, and it says they go down, like, live into Sheol, right? Why doesn't this happen to Aaron now, right? Like, surely he's earned it. Why isn't he, at the very least, like, excommunicated and, like, exiled from the camp? Like, can you imagine if this happened here today, and I had brought in a statue and put it up here and said, like, "This is your God," right? Am I keeping my job? You know, am I, like, fit for future ministry here at church? Like, I'm, like, out of here. I'm, like, back to America or something, right? It's, like, it's a big deal. So, you know, we do know that from Deuteronomy 9 that God, like, he was certainly angry at Aaron. It says that he was angry enough to destroy Aaron. And we know that Moses intercedes on his behalf and asks for forgiveness. But even though Moses asked God for forgiveness, like, ultimately, it just comes down to the fact that God gave Aaron and the people another chance, right? He said he was angry enough to destroy the whole nation and then just start again with Moses. But then he relents and he gives them another chance to choose him over other gods. So we get this in 26, starting in 26. "And Moses stood at the camp's entrance and said, 'Whoever is for the Lord, come to me.' And all the Levites gathered around him. He told them, 'This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Every man fasten his sword to his side, go back and forth through the camp from entrance to entrance, and each of you kill his brother, his friend, his neighbor.' The Levites did as Moses commanded, and about 3,000 men fell dead that day among the people. Afterwards, Moses said, 'Today you have been dedicated to the Lord, since each man went against his son and his brother. Therefore, you have brought a blessing on yourselves today.'" So in this, one commenter that I read, he emphasized that it's important to note that it wasn't only the Levites who came to Moses, but what the passage is emphasizing is that they were the only complete tribe, that heeded Moses' call to come back to God. So he argues, like you could read 26 as saying something like, Moses asked for the people to come back to the Lord, and of those who came, all of the Levites gathered around him. So something like that. Like that's how I feel that the narrative fits the best. If Moses calls the Levites to then go and judge those who continued to reject the Lord, like obviously at the end of the day, we weren't only left with the tribe of Levite remaining. The 3,000 were those who still didn't come back to God, even when they had another chance to choose him over other gods. So with this done, and those who didn't come back to God, like removed from among the people, the chapter ends with stern words from God. He says that those who sin against him will be blotted out of his book, and that even though they may live now, you know, judgment day will someday come. And this sounds harsh, right? But it's a reality that we understand about any sin against God, right? You know, any sin that we commit is this barrier between us and God, and without some kind of intervention, like we will be blotted out of the book of life, and like that's the end, right? So God is repeating an overarching truth about just sin in general. And then the passage, the chapter ends with a plague striking the Israelite camp in rebuke of what they did. But then in that, the passage doesn't specify if like more people died from this or not. So it's very specific about how many people died at the hand of the Levites, but it doesn't specify that people died from this plague. So we just don't know. So that's how 32 ends. But then after this, in chapters 33 and 34, we kind of get a whole new story. A whole new chapter begins to open up for the nation of Israel. The people show that they're repentant for what they did. Moses continues to convene with God and again asks that God would forgive them of their sin and continue to lead them into the promised land. And then God just does. He just forgives them. He asks Moses to get two more stone tablets, and he forges a new covenant with the people, repeating what he said to them before when they first arrived at Mount Sinai. Despite their infidelity, despite their idolatry, despite their sexual immorality and their stubbornness, the Israelites didn't get what they deserved, and they are instead gifted with what they don't deserve. Right? There is profound mercy and grace in these chapters of Exodus. Especially for Aaron, right? Even though he came back to God, like who in their right mind would promote this guy into priesthood after crafting an idol with his own hands, right? Apparently, the person who would do this also promotes us into priesthood, despite us crafting countless of idols in our lives, putting other things before God, rejecting his way, seizing control for ourselves. If we look at 1 Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 9, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his possession, so that you may proclaim the praises of the one who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." As Christians, we are adopted into God's covenant to Abraham and Israel. And through Jesus, we take on the mantle of being a nation of priests, charged with bringing God's blessings to all the nations of the world, with Jesus as our head. By no means are we worthy of priesthood, and yet God raises us up and attributes us with Jesus' righteousness when we follow after him. Surely the people's story is our story too, right? Finding new idols to fill God's position in our lives at every turn. You know, money, status, security, popularity, romance, entertainment. I would warn you to guard yourselves from making idols in your life, but I know it would do no good, right? We are all profoundly corrupted in this way. And it's only Jesus that can truly change us and satisfy us, right? A warning isn't enough. But Aaron's story is also our story, right? As Christians, us having made idols, we are nonetheless able to repent and not only just survive God's wrath, but we are lifted up into a position of honor. If you haven't yet come back to be under Jesus' banner, you know, this offer stands for you as well. Right? This is what God has done for us. I challenge you in the week to come to just continue thinking about what this says about who God is. What is his true character? What does it mean that he is loving and merciful and forgiving? And for you specifically, right? This isn't just an abstract concept. When we say that, I have been idolatrous and God forgives me of that, like, it's as real as what Aaron had done, right? What does God's grace and mercy really mean for you? And also, if it's true that we are raised into priesthood, what does that mean for you? What does that mean for God's call in your life? Where are you going with that? How are you engaging in God's call to participate in that? So with all of these things, yeah, let's just close by praying that, yeah, God will continue to speak to us, continue to work in us for that. Yeah, and especially as we go out from this place. So let's pray. Yeah, Lord, we come to you and we praise you. We praise you for who you are. We praise you for the profound depths of your love, your forgiveness, your mercy, you don't exile us, you don't excommunicate us, you give us a way out, you give us a way to choose you, to come back to you, and to come back to you as if nothing had ever happened, completely reconciled, adopted as sons and daughters. I pray that we can continue to understand what that really means, what that really looks like, that that's not just an abstract concept, but that's a tangible and concrete reality for us. And yeah, pray that we can also continue to understand what it means to be your children, to be a nation of priests, to be representatives of Jesus to everyone around us, to be these arbiters of your gospel, conveyors of your blessing to the very ends of the earth. And yeah, again, we just praise you that this is your plan for this world. This is your plan for us in our lives. And yeah, we're grateful for that. And yeah, all these things we pray in Jesus' name.